Hello everyone, I'm Nate Truax, and you're listening to the CrocCast Podcast.
Hello everyone, welcome to the CrocCast Podcast. I'm your host Nate, and today I'm joined by Zach Bell of the Okinawa Kame Center for the Conservation of the Ryukyu Black-Breasted Leaf Turtle. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Nate.
So you want to start off a little bit about yourself first, kind of how you down to reptiles and what led you all the way to Okinawa?
Sure. I'll be brief. You know, I grew up in rural part of Tennessee, so lots of reptiles, nice warm weather for the most part in the summertime. So earliest memories were snakes and lizards and things like that. My father was and still is an outdoorsman, so he would always bring different things home. Not something I condone these days, but back then, you know, if you had a passion for reptiles, it was sort of seen as a bit of an oddity. And so I think that might be one of the reasons I liked it. It was maybe because it was unique or some level of, you know, sympathy for these animals. You know, it was as if, you know, if we didn't care for them, who would, type of thing. Because a lot of people, other than maybe some of the turtles, you know, didn't get that much positive attention. But, you know, later on, I would go on to keep various pet reptiles, all of your standard stuff, nothing too exotic, green iguanas, curly-tailed lizards, what else did I have, different snakes, ball pythons, most of what you could buy at a pet store back then, nothing too exotic. I think the most exotic pet reptile I had back then was a rainbow panther chameleon, and that was like a big deal for a small kid. This would have been early 90s, mid 90s, to have this in Tennessee was kind of strange. But other than that, your standard reptiles, and I've had pet reptiles on and off most of my life. So I thought I would do something with reptiles as a career. When I went to college, I spoke with an advisor and told him I wanted to work with reptiles and a few ideas, but I wasn't really pointed towards a biology department or anything. It was more, you should consider how you could, you know, make money off of this, make a business. And I think I spent one semester thinking about maybe I should do something as a conservation, like a nonprofit or a business, but didn't really stick with that very long. Ended up kind of double majoring in health science area and in biology, thinking that maybe the health science would probably fund or be the career path because you could go into medicine or physical therapy, some type of profession, something like that, or medical path. But eventually I fell into research and wanted to do something again with reptiles, but there wasn't anybody doing the type of work I was interested in. So I kind of stuck with the traditional, maybe biomedical science and clinical science for quite a bit of time, and worked in different research labs, spoke with vets and people of different professions, and seemed like nobody could point me in the direction of working with reptiles. And at that point, I became sort of hopeless in a way. You know, I'd met only one or two herpetologists, and they weren't doing what I wanted to do. You know, they were doing maybe more wildlife biology, conservation stuff. And I was really more interested in kind of the hardcore biology, the basic science stuff. And I was fortunate to meet Jeff Corwin when I was, you know, after I finished my undergrad. And years ago, he was sort of famous, you know, for being on television. I think he's sort of reemerged in recent years, or maybe in the past 5 or 10 years. But back then, you know, he was almost, it almost seemed like he had retired. So he had written a book called 100 Heartbeats. And there's a long line to go to his lecture and to sign his book. And I waited, I sat on the curb and waited for the line to die down. And I kind of ran up as the last person, you know, just kind of told him, like, look, here's my position. I really want to work with reptiles. And I knew he had a background with reptiles and, you know, what was his advice. And he gave me different ideas. And eventually I found a laboratory that would allow me to at least learn the techniques to study, you know, non-traditional model organisms. I ended up working with birds, but, you know, you can really learn some good techniques to work with birds that you could transfer over to working with, again, non-traditional biomedical system. So instead of working with mice or fruit flies and things like this, which you would see in a biomedical setting, to work with something maybe more exotic, it's because the molecular tools and methods for working on, you know, more fundamental questions of biology just didn't exist for outside of these non-traditional model organisms. But after going to graduate school and working with birds, I spent a little bit more time with birds. That's how I ended up in Japan, in Okinawa, which is one of the most southern islands of Japan. And while here, I stumbled across this really rare turtle species that lives in the wild that's, you know, you rarely see. They're endangered, and I learned that there wasn't a major conservation effort, and they were biologically quite interesting in their behaviors. They climbed mountains. They lived, you know, really, you know, I'd say dangerous for human type of situations, you know, on the side of a ledge where, you know, just to even try to find one or see one was, you know, quite risky. And so I thought, wow, this is a cool animal. It has really interesting behaviors. It's not a large animal. You know, maybe I could use some of my ideas in animal behavior and interest in reptiles that I learned with birds and apply them to this turtle. And not only that, but this is an animal that's sort of in need for conservation. So there's kind of a two-pronged approach here. I could both potentially save or help protect an animal, but on the other hand, do some interesting biology. So that's how I ended up, you know, all the way here in Okinawa working with a turtle.
So were you the one that founded the center, or was that an organization you bumped into by accident?
Yeah, great question. Actually, I was a co-founder. So my partner here, you know, I had started a smaller technology company when I was at a university here. And, you know, she and I both do a lot of hiking and spending time outdoors. So, you know, she was equally interested. So she and I both co-founded it. But I would say the research on the species started, you know, decades ago. You can imagine there's people that have been interested in this turtle for probably over 100 years, but in, you know, since the early 90s and maybe even before then, there's been some local individuals, both Japanese and Okinawan, who have to some degree monitored the turtles. In some cases would go out and capture some animals and describe them, or they would, you know, kind of look regionally where they found, because, you know, there's different types of wildlife surveys that are conducted here as there is in the US. But one individual kind of took over and said, you know, I'm going to go out and do these field studies. His name is Mr. Otani. And he would go out and essentially do a capture mark recapture study, where you capture the animal, collect some data on it, mark the shell so you'd know that individual, and then you'd release it and then repeat this, you know, over the year. So I would say the research itself into this animal, you know, I'd say the bulk of it really started with him and his student, Ms. Toyama. But, you know, they had really gotten older, not really Ms. Toyama, but she had taken on personal responsibility. She'd started a family. She was just his student. But she really loved the turtles. And I'd say she's, you know, probably 50% or more of the research, because she kind of kept everything organized and, you know, managed it, versus Mr. Otani was just out the guy who wanted to go out and collect turtles, although she joined him many times. But I'd say that's where it kind of started. But there was no company, there was no organization to it, other than this was just sort of a fun hobby in many ways. It wasn't sponsored by the government. There was no funding outside of maybe the initial start of it. But once we came here and got interested in the turtle, we met them. And this was kind of during the pandemic time. We realized, wow, there's all this interesting research, but it hasn't been done in decades, and it's sort of slowly dying out. What if we kind of picked up, you know, the fire and carried it forward, but not only carried forward this sort of more field conservation work, but really took it to the next level and applied some of these more fundamental biological questions and approaches that are, say, a little more modern in the laboratory to conservation as well as behavior. So although we founded it, Aya and myself, the co-founders, we brought them on immediately because we could, you know, obviously they had all this value from decades before.
Okay. And just for people who aren't familiar with the species, do you want to give a brief rundown on the leaf turtle?
Sure. So there's a small species. If you think of your iPhone or a standard, you know, smartphone, this animal would fit on the footprint of that. So quite small. On occasion, they become larger, but I'd say that's the exception. So The average is around 12 centimeters long, you know, from top, from head to tail, or I should say, we're talking just the shell itself, top to bottom, and then width is around 8 centimeters. So it has about the footprint of a standard smartphone, although their legs and tail can give them, you know, extra centimeter length. But they're quite unique in the sense that they climb mountains, they climb hills, they essentially live in this, you know, semi-vertical terrain. And if you could imagine, this is a semi-tropical island chain. And so there's a lot of islands down here, hundreds, and it depends on who you're asking. They might be more or less than, you know, 150 or something like that islands. They're kind of restricted to a few of these islands. Three is the current estimate, based on the populations, but they live on these islands. They tend to be in the only in the forests, although there have been many exceptions in recent years. They range in color, so they can be a sort of a brown, orangey color, but many are actually quite bright red. So to see a really bright red turtle is quite unique. So a small, bright red turtle, the males have a really long tail, almost like you'd see with a snapping turtle or a lizard or something, really long tail, which they kind of use as some type of steering tool to kind of navigate up and around, and almost as you can think of as an extra appendage to kind of tripod when climbing. But that's another thing, is you will find them perched up on the sides of trees, on the sides of, you know, a cliff. So it's almost like a bird in the sense that they get this vantage point. And there's, you know, we don't really understand these behaviors at all, but we kind of speculate because they hang out on these edges. It's really, there's a valley in between them. So if you think of a mountain that has a point, we have all these mountains around these islands, and the mountains kind of break off and have these valleys all around them in different directions. And when it rains, the water hits the top and it kind of rolls down out into the ocean. When we're surrounded by the ocean, you know, these are islands. So if you're too close to the bottom of the stream, maybe you get washed out, especially in typhoon season. And that's sort of where some of the predators like boar and crows can more easily capture you. So being able to kind of have a vantage point and be away from potential dangers is, you know, probably put you in a safer position. But they're extreme, at probably all ends of the spectrum when it comes to small turtles, you know, not just their climbing and not just the coloration, but also their feeding behavior. They're quite aggressive, especially if there's live prey involved. Although it hasn't been well observed in the wild under captive situations, such as if an animal is taken to a zoo, or even people that have captive bred these animals, you know, to watch them feed is quite a show. A lot of people make videos of them hunting worms and things because it's so unusual, the lizard-like abilities of this turtle. But they are endangered, at least at this point, but they have not been reassessed by the IUCN in over 25 years. So it's been a quarter century. And that's really the goal of our organization, is to reassess them, which we've, you know, already made steps towards that. But our official data logging for this assessment is this year 2025.
Okay. So these are our montane species. You don't really find them in the lowlands of Okinawa or the Ryukyus, and more hillside.
For the most, I mean, this is the weird thing, you know, they've been described, you know, the name in Japanese is Ryukyu Yamagame. Ryukyu just is the name of the island chain, and Ryukyu itself is a Japanese name. So just to give some context, these islands are not Japanese islands historically. There was a whole civilization here, and they become part of Japan just the same way that Hawaii is American. These are, you know, Japanese islands. They have their own culture. You know, even today, I believe there's over 6 different languages still spoken across these islands. Even locally, you know, older people, when they're talking to you, you have no idea what they're saying sometimes, or it's a mix of Japanese and one of the several Okinawan languages. But locally, we say Ryukyu because Ryukyu was a kingdom here. So you always say Ryukyu, black-breasted leaf turtle, but the Japanese is Ryukyu Yamagame, and even locally they'll refer to them as Yamagame. And Yama means mountain in Japanese, Gami means turtle, or Game means turtle. And I say this because different dialects say gami, some say game, but they call them mountain turtles, but they are found sometimes walking on the beach here. You know, it's like, you know, maybe they're just exploring. Sometimes we find them in the water, which again, historically, most people say, you know, you never see them in the water. You know, that's a rare event, but we found them in the water. And when you look at their anatomy, they're, you know, they don't appear to be built for the water and they're not graceful swimmers. So maybe they were just, you know, they fell in or were, you know, trying to get to the other side of the river or something. But they have been found in the southern parts of Okinawa Island, which is a little more urbanized and it's more farmland area. But it's thought that maybe these are, you know, because of fragmented forests is why they're down there. And these are long lost, or they were, somebody had them as pets illegally and just released them. And that's how they ended up down there. But for the most part, they tend to be in the mountainous areas. And it's mostly because the fragmentation is caused by farming and you know, just different development, you know, commercial development, things like that. But it is, you know, there are exceptions for sure, but they do seem to be forest dwelling for the most part.
Okay. And have you done any dietary studies on like what we say makes up a large part of the species diet?
Yeah, great question. I mean, these are the types of things we're wanting to get after because a lot of it is sort of speculation at this point. There have been students at a local university who have kind of analyzed the poop in a very, we'll say, low-tech level, right? They're kind of sifting through it and seeing, you know, what parts of different animals might be present. But other than that, there hasn't been a lot of observation. They're quite cryptic. And so even if you can find them in the wild, which is you're lucky if you do that, they freeze up or they've seen you before you've seen them. So it's rare that you see them hunting in the wild. But from our experience and then some local photographers, as well as our two team members who I've mentioned who have been doing research on these animals for decades before we even arrived to Okinawa, snails seem to be on the menu. You will very frequently find them around snails as if they had just been eating them. You'll find pieces of shell or sort of slime stuck to their face. So it appears that they do like snails, although observing them do it, the behavior itself, I have not yet seen it, but I have seen it on video. Another thing is there's lots of seeds in the fecal material. So we assume that they're eating a variety of different berries that we've to some degree identified locally, you know, and seasonally. There's small like millipedes that they also appear to eat. Again, this is, you can see this sort of in the fecal material. And then on occasion, people have found them, including one of our advisors, with a small like frog in their mouth. You know, it kind of hunted it down and caught a frog. And there's lots of different species of frogs here. So quite omnivorous, as I'm trying to describe here. And then under captive situations, they'll take to almost anything you've put in there when it comes to invertebrates. They like even meat. You know, if you were to put in, say, a piece of chicken or something, raw meat, they'll eat that as well. But as well as they tend to like fruits and vegetables, they don't seem to discriminate. And a lot of the study here has been quite confusing because one of the field sites is a road that sort of one side is farmland, one side is their sort of natural forest. So you can imagine a road like this where there's a forest and mountain on one side, and then there's farmland over here, and you can find the turtles around there. But it appears that there's more turtles there than there are in the natural forest where there's forest on both sides, because all these fruits from the farmers are easy foods like citrus fruits and things like that, as well as the insects that eat those fruits. Those are also targets, and they kind of roll in sort of the ditches along those roads. So they seem to be quite opportunistic, but any formal studies that I would consider, you know, strong evidence for feeding behavior and food preference, I have yet to see that, but we're going to do that hopefully.
Okay. So we say they're diet is maybe somewhat similar to box turtles here in the U.S.?
I think so, yep, exactly. Even the even the beak is quite hooked. So just like a box turtle. So I think that's definitely an indicator of being able to capture prey. So they're not, you know, you don't see some other type of adaptation. So it appears that prey is definitely something that they're going after. Live prey or being able to tear seems to be important for their feeding.
Okay. And you mentioned crows and boars, but what are some of the natural predators that these that this very small species of turtle face, even as an adult size?
We think, you know, besides humans, and people aren't hunting these for food or for medicinal use, you know, just from car accidents and things like that, but crows probably are your best bet. You know, crows are extremely smart, and we have a species here that, you know, it's like a more of a jungle species. So many crows kind of hang out on power lines and hang out in open areas and chat. But these guys are kind of, they do that, but they're also deep in the forest. And so they're really agile, can kind of go in. And as I mentioned, there's sort of valleys, and those valleys are just highways for these animals. And so anytime we're out looking for turtles or doing a survey, we have to be mindful of these crows, because if I go dig around in a, you know, one little hole area and then I walk away, you'll see a crow fly down there and check it out. Like he knows, oh, that human, you know, must be doing something interesting. I should go investigate. Boars, I think, are probably the second, you know, top predator. And I say that because they basically destroy the forest, especially in the cooler season. So when you're looking in the forest right now, even in a dark forest, you know, the bottom's covered with ferns and greenery, you know, sun kind of breaks through there. But in the wintertime, the food's less. So the boars just basically destroy the land and kind of dig down, you know, several, you know, maybe 10, 20 centimeters down. And so any turtles that might be down in the dirt hiding or kind of brumating during this cooler season, those would just be crunched up. You know, they're not immune to a boar. And I'd say the boar is the only large land mammal here. Other than that, we do have several snakes that we know eat turtles, at least sea turtles. There's a few snakes that just, they're known as sort of, at least one is known as like a predator for like baby sea turtles. So they kind of hang out on the beach, wait for them to hatch, and they just go after the baby turtles. And these are like, you know, a couple meter long snakes. They're quite large, and they share, there's some similar, you know, crossover in the, where you find both the turtle and the snake species. So we think also snakes, but that's really it. You know, there's not a being subtropical, it's not as biologically diverse as you would think it would be. There's a lot of different species of, you know, maybe frog or bird, and even that's rare, but this is the only native turtle species here, just to give you an idea. So it's, you know, there's one boar, there's the crow, the snake. Other than that, we do have a few invasive species here that were brought over historically, everything from cats and dogs to Indian mongoose. And it's thought that, you know, those are responsible because those animals have been responsible for killing other animals. And so there's a lot of controlling those populations and trying to eliminate them. But we don't know that they're necessarily taking down the turtles, just given that you don't see the same crossover in environments with those sort of feral, the cats and dogs, as well as with the mongoose. So we think boar, snake, and crow.
Okay. And so besides predators, including various species, and you kind of hinted to this before, but what are some of the major threats to species? And I'm guessing human development would be a key contributor.
Absolutely, yeah. The human development component, you know, or not human development, the land development component caused by humans is a big one here. And that can be both for commercial purposes, for the tourism industry. Back post-war times here, you know, this, you know, some historical context, this was sort of the last site of World War II. And, you know, this island was essentially American occupation from 1945 to, I believe, 1972. So 27 years, something like that, under 30 for sure. But part of the rebuilding structure here, you know, there was a heavy emphasis on tourism. And since the American occupation, tourism has been one of the main economic drivers. So a lot of resorts along the beaches here, which are beautiful beaches, and that's sort of attracted more businesses such as restaurants and housing and roads. And then there's a lot of farming as well. So both of these sort of take away forest and natural land, but they also put roads in between those natural things. So you end up getting if you didn't destroy their habitat, you've built a road that now, they can be injured or killed when they cross it. Those are your main ones. There has been speculation about, we don't see the turtles around agricultural areas as much. So maybe there's chemicals from the, pesticides or fertilizers that are damaging the reproductive system. I haven't seen evidence to support that. We know that that happens in other places in the world. But it kind of goes against what I've seen, because I've seen more of them around those agricultural areas because there's more food than anything. But I think the main ones tend to be human development. But you have to imagine, right, this turtle that can fit in the palm of your hand, that's red, that's, almost lizard-like, has all these unique behaviors, makes a great pet for some people. And so that's a major risk for the animal, is they're poached and taken immediately into the captive pet trade. The papers are fixed to make them look like they were captive bred, and you have people purchasing these animals thinking, oh, I have this great animal and I'm keeping it in captivity and it's captive bred, and I have a little piece of Okinawa here in my home. But I think what some of those people might not be aware of is that the animal isn't captive bred. It was taken from its home here, and it's contributing to the loss of biodiversity here and the gene pool for this species.
Okay. And what would you say is the best way to conserve the species?
Well, right now it's going to have to be research. We've got these 25 years of data collected from two of our colleagues who I mentioned earlier, Mr. Otani and Ms. Toyama, 20 years of data, but this wasn't collected in a way for performing some sophisticated data analysis to be able to predict population size and density and all these sort of modern measures of how we can both understand a population and how we could implement management tools to protect and conserve that moving forward. So because of that lack of, we'll say, quality data that you would need to do conservation research, we have to go out and kind of in some ways start from scratch. And so we're collecting animals and understanding where they're at, where they're not at, and where they potentially should be. Are they no longer in a particular region because they were never there? Is there any historical data, from, just documentation from each different village? And then how do we maintain them, and how do those populations fare over time? So research, research, research. I can't say that enough. And an issue here is I'm not a conservation biologist. And I'm trained in neuroscience and molecular biology of animal behavior and animal communication. So I'm having to learn all this. So there's also, I have to do a lot of research and collaboration with the pros, because this is not my area of expertise at all. I'm not a turtle biologist or herpetologist. Although, maybe I'm an amateur herpetologist. But the research has to be done both in the field as well as in the laboratory, because we now have, sophisticated techniques where if we have a small handful of animals in different regions on these different islands, we can do some really fancy computational work to predict what those populations look like, the health of them, the density, the size. And that's really where I'm trying to use my expertise, is the sort of computational and bioinformatic side of things. So we are collecting animals, collecting tissue, so we can then sequence, and then we can start to build a picture of what that looks like. But going out and capturing every turtle and knowing where every one of them is would be the best situation. But that's an impossible feat, even with hundreds of people. I can go out right now under perfect conditions and not find a single animal. And did I just waste my time? How can I, it's really hard to even find them, let alone do research. So any animal we collect is good data, because we can then mark that animal or see if it's already been marked by our colleagues in the past. And we can kind of try to understand where its sort of a range is. They don't seem to go too far, less than a kilometer away from where they're captured over decades. Sometimes, you know, an animal that's been recaptured multiple times, they don't seem to go too far, but we assume there's probably some individuals who leave in order to sort of, you know, you see this in other species, right? To, you know, look for new genetics. They're not looking for it, you know, cognitively, but there's some sort of behavior to leave the region to find others for mating. But that's something that we're trying to use as well for the bioinformatical, or we should say just the more computational approaches, where instead of just having to collect animals, we're trying to do some more eDNA work as well. So we recently sequenced the genome of the species, and we're looking for some unique genetic markers that'll be used as tools for eDNA. So every time we go out now, we can collect soil and water samples. And if we find a turtle, wow, that's great. But if not, we still have something that we can assay for. Was there a presence of this animal? And not only just this animal, maybe we could even look for predators and other potential prey items that we might speculate they might be interested in, just to build that map. But the research has to come first, and it is both a laboratory and a field exercise if we want to conserve them. Now, when it comes to protection, you know, we just need to buy land, right? You know, if you can protect the land, that's a great first step. You know, you can isolate it and, you know, and then worry about the conservation management later, just to prevent it from being used. And that is an opportunity that we are, you know, we're willing to take such an opportunity if it arises. But it's quite rare. Most people who don't sell property here, and you tend to need to know a local person who wants to get rid of property. The good thing is that most people don't want to farm or build resorts on mountains. And that's where the turtles seem to live. So that's one thing that they have going for them. It's the worst type of property to, you know, people don't want mountains here. They want the flat land. So that's one thing they have working for them.
Yeah. But speaking of your research, have you done any research on, say, like courtship behavior, nesting behavior, and sort of that type of reproductive behavior?
Not in the wild. They're so cryptic. You don't see them. And I should mention, we've really only been doing this for about 5 years, which sounds like a long time, but in Japanese years, it's like 2 months, because it's really bureaucratic, and, you know, it's very difficult to do things here. There's a lot of rules you have to follow and boxes you have to tick. But we haven't done that. But under captive situations, people have made those types of observations. So courtship behavior at the zoos here, so animals that were wild once that have been taken to a zoo, which happens more often than it should. You know, somebody finds an animal on the road, they're like, oh, we just saved it. It ends up at the zoo and it lives the rest of its life at the zoo, unfortunately, because they have a policy, can't re-release it right now. And then people who have kept these animals abroad, who have either, you know, purchased them or they've been captive bred. So those types of observations have been done. So when it comes to I would say most of those studies are flawed, or observations are flawed. And it's really just, whether it be a zoo or somebody's house, they're introducing the male and female, you know, once per year to have a breeding behavior. That's not natural, right? You're going to stumble upon these, you know, this situation in the wild where, you know, what are the mate selection? Well, if you only have one option, you know, is that really the natural behavior? Does one actually want to be involved in this situation? Well, they don't have a choice now that you put them in. So
it's the animal equivalent of arranged marriage.
Exactly. It's animal arranged marriage. So every observation I've heard described and seen, I don't know that it's natural. It's definitely, you know, if your metric is, did the male mount the female, and what's the, you know, the gap of time between putting the animal down or them seeing them? You can take all these measurements you want, but I'm not sure how, you know, realistic they are, how ethologically relevant the data is. I would say the most naturalistic observations have been done here, just because they have made sort of more naturalistic enclosures. The climate's the same as what it would be, you know. Basically, there's a zoo, and then on this side there's rural ones, and over here there's a natural living ones, and these have just had to be put over here. So they have, it's very good, you know, comparison maybe although I'd say they're smaller. I'm trying to think. This is one of the reasons I'm interested in the species. I mean, it's like a gold mine. There's all these cool things we can talk about doing, right? Behavior, mating behaviors, feeding behaviors. You know, what are they doing at nighttime? You know, it's all, you know, fair game for research to do. I mean, even in most reptile species, this isn't like a heavily studied area. So especially in this one where I have the rest of my life to do this cool stuff.
Yeah. But have you observed any interesting behavior of them, the rock climbing and tripoding in the wild? Have you observed any other interesting behaviors in the species?
The tail of the males is quite interesting, how they locomote. So when they're running, you'll see it in the males, females, even the babies, but there's this, as they're walking, the tail, they kind of drag it. So it sometimes it'll be pointed out parallel with the ground, but sometimes they'll actually drag it, especially the males. But you see the behavior in both. It's sort of this left and right movement as they walk that I'm not seeing in other turtles, but you can imagine the males have this longer tail and they'll use it almost to like steer themselves. So you'll see them running away from me, for example. They see me and I see them and they know it's, you know, do or die, I have to escape from this guy. They'll run and they'll use that tail like a rudder. I mean, they'll literally like drop it and curve and then curve back this way, and you can just, that tail is key in it. So I think that's one of the cool observations that I've seen. And it clearly appears to be in both sexes and of all ages, but you know, the females and the younger ones just don't have that anatomy. They have the behavior. So it's appears to have been selected for both sexes, but only the males can take full advantage of it. Although, you know, both species tend to be beat up pretty bad as they get older. And that's another cool observation, is they have these ticks. And that's something that we started working with a parasitologist recently. I say working, planning stages. We haven't actually started the work, but I'd been trying to do some virology, immunology work with the turtles related to these ticks. And I found somebody who was also interested in, he's a tick biologist, I'm more of a turtle biology person. So we're trying to come together here. But from what I've seen, that these ticks start on these turtles at a very young age. So even hatchlings can have, not hatchlings, but maybe a month old, you'll see these animals with ticks on them. But they'll have ticks, I mean, just completely on top of the carapace. I didn't know turtles could get ticks on top of their shells until I moved here. But, you know, the ticks will go right in between some scutes and they'll, you know, bite down. And there's some question of when they get older, they have all the scarring. And I'm quite convinced that this is part of just living in a mountainous terrain and them falling a lot. They do fall. And then they also attack each other. That's another behavior that's been observed in captivity where, you know, they'll bite the backs of the shells of both males and females, which you see in other turtle species. It's not new here, but anytime that there's an injury, it's almost like the ticks move in and then they'll just kind of erode that area. So they'll just really destroy an animal's shell over time, one of these turtle shells. But I had a veterinarian from Europe recently mention in a comment that, oh, actually, all that damage back there could have been the ticks themselves. They could have started off small and just created that large wound. Maybe it didn't actually come from maybe a car accident or from falling. Maybe the ticks themselves. So that's something we're trying to understand. But turtles in general have a very, we'll say, like, it's sort of like a weak immune response. Like it's kind of delayed. And so they have some sort of non-specific, you know, way of dealing with pathogens that's very different from mammalian immune systems. But that's something that we've become quite interested in, because the ticks that they have carry different types of bacteria, and these bacteria themselves also have viruses. But the tick bacteria, something like different species of Borrelia, Ehrlichia, Rickettsia, you know, these are known types of bacteria that can be pathogenic to humans. And so we don't know if they're walking around, you know, like little, you know, disease, you know, and, you know, like, should we even be doing field studies, right? We could be putting ourselves at risk, you know, for some crazy zoonotic spillover, you know, so we need to do that type of work.
Yeah, gotta be careful. Don't turn the turtle into a plague rat.
Yeah, I mean, it's it has become concerning because the ticks seem to really, and then this is not unique to this species. I think turtles in general, there's a lot of examples where reptiles have a particular leech that just likes them, a particular tick or something, a particular parasite. But where it's unclear the life cycle of the tick and the turtle, right? You know, we know that there's a life cycle to being a tick. You know, you have a feed, and then you kind of go into the ground, and then you come back and you have a second feed, and you go back into the ground, you have a third feed, and then you complete this life cycle. It isn't clear if there's anybody else besides the tick and the turtle in this sort of a circle of life for this tick. And are, you know, is there any health benefits? And you know, what are the biomedical implications? From what I've read in recent years, ticks aren't always so parasitic as you would think. So that sometimes they can provide some benefit to the host that's not so evident. It's not just, we know that the tick's getting something out of this, but maybe the turtle's getting something out of this relationship as well. Because in some cases, they could easily remove them. You know, they're in places, you know, the ticks are clever and they do get in, you know, behind the hind legs and tail and parts of the shell where the turtle couldn't maybe get them off well, but turtles bask. They can dry out. They can also, you know, we found them in streams. In some ways, they probably could remove them, especially you'll find them in between the front toes. Like literally, I mean, where you, they could just bite it off because you'll see them, you know, biting themselves all the time, you know, different, you know, if there's a little extra food, for example, they might kind of, they don't lick, but they kind of bite at their foot to get the extra snail off or something. So we know that they could probably remove it. So we don't understand why do they put up with this? Or is it really a choice? So the tick observation is a unique one because it's, again, it's a turtle that's the size of a phone that can be bright red like a stop sign that's covered in ticks on the side of a mountain with wounds all over it. I mean, it's a weird animal.
Yeah. Okay. So moving away from turtles a bit, what's got some of the other herpetofauna that you find on Okinawa?
Yeah, so there's a few species of geckos here. Some are your standard, like house geckos, which I believe those are invasive, but they're kind of long-term invasive species. And then there's a ground geckos here. There's at least two different species. And then there's, I believe, a variation on some of the islands here, but they look like, I don't know if you ever type in like Japanese cave gecko, I think that's what they're called in English, but they're really Okinawan species, but they look kind of like maybe like a leopard gecko or something like that. Small claws, but they're really good climbers, surprisingly. So you can think of a leopard gecko that's super agile, a little skinny, quite beautiful. They're nocturnal, so you really have to, you know, we don't see them as often because we're not out at nighttime, but if we do go out at nighttime or in the edge of night, we'll see them. Several species of snakes. So I mentioned one of the predators of the turtle is the Akamata. I didn't mention the name, but it's called an Akamata. It's this long, you know, can be 2, maybe even like 3 meters long. I mean, these are some enormous snakes. They're not poisonous, or at least not, I shouldn't say poisonous, venomous. Sorry about that. They might be slightly venomous, but they're not dangerous to humans. I believe so. I can look this up real quick.
Okay. You know what their scientific name is?
Yeah, so it looks like the Lycodone semicarinatus. I'm going to send it through right now. You can see.
Lycodone, yeah, that sounds like a real thing, genus.
And I believe the name has changed a few times, maybe even in recent years for this.
Oh, yeah, it's the wolf snakes. Okay.
Are you familiar with this?
Not particularly, but I've heard the name thrown around before.
They're quite aggressive. You know, it's one of the interesting thing about this snake. It's like they're not afraid. They hold their ground. So if you come across one and you think, oh, I'm going to take a stick and move it. No, I mean, I don't recommend it because they're just really aggressive, but really beautiful. People do keep them as pets here. Surprisingly, I'm not sure if it's allowed, but there are, you know, I think if you get them when they're small, I'm sure you can turn them into friends. I don't know, but they, they are known turtle eaters, and because of probably their size, and they like hanging out on the beach to get the sea turtle. So there's, you know, speaking of different reptiles here, we have a variety of turtles from around the world come here to nest on the beaches. So there's I don't know that it's all sea turtle species, but most of them, I feel like, come here. Green sea turtles. What are the other ones?
Loggerhead?
Well, Oliver, I should know this. So it tells you I'm not a herpetologist or a turtle biologist. I don't know all this stuff. Olive Ridley turtles are here. Let's see. I want to say I've seen a picture of a loggerhead turtle, but I don't know if it was nesting here or washed up. Mm-hmm. Loggerhead turtle. So let's just find this out real quick before I start. It says northern Japan, there's a place. It ranges from Okinawa to Honshu, which is the mainland of Japan. Yeah, apparently they're here. Unless Google's lying to me here.
This is entirely possible.
It totally is these days. But yeah, you see a variety of we'll say sea turtle species. Well, which ones? The mystery remains. But you can see them as well just from the beach or standing off a cliff. So if you look over a cliff, you can see them out there kind of hunting and hanging out. It's a very popular place to dive to see turtles here. We have sea crates. So the snakes that live in the ocean here, and they're quite common. It's not if you walk on the beach every day, you're going to find one on the beach. It's not a rare instance. They really like divers. They're really attracted to bubbles. So as you're breathing out, the snakes will come up to you. First time I ever went diving here, I was told, look, the snakes are going to come up to you. Don't worry about it. And, you know, again, the guy I go out with, he's handing me these snakes. And, you know, they'll just come right up to you, and they're not aggressive at all. But they really are attracted to the bubbles for some reason as you breathe out. So those guys are everywhere.
Okay, that's probably just reacting to the shimmer, like maybe small fish, but
a spit. Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. For sure. Don't know why, but I don't know. They don't appear to be afraid of humans. They are a delicacy. So people, you know, the elderly here will still catch them and eat them. It's sort of an old tradition there's a whole process of how they prepare the meat and dry it out and then prepare it for a soup. But it's not so common. It's, again, one of these rare dishes. We do have a lot of pit vipers here. Those are kind of those are the snakes that most people know about. They don't necessarily know about they don't think about the sea snakes. They don't think about the akamatas. There's a few other small arboreal snakes here that we see, although I think maybe when they get older, they're not so arboreal because they get so big. But because I see them on the ground more than anything, but the small ones I see kind of running around. And we can just probably Google reptiles of Okinawa here. I'm quite laser focused when I go to the jungle to find animals. So I'm looking
here for turtles and turtles only, pretty much.
Well, I'm looking for turtles and not in trying to avoid getting attacked by these vipers. So these vipers, that locally called the Habu viper. So if you type in Habu, they come in a few different flavors. So there's the Himehabu, which is it's a small brown. It reminds me of like a copperhead type of snake in the U.S. They're kind of short and, you know, thick snake, but they're not so aggressive. You know, they're quite, if they're in your way or you want to get by them, they definitely just want to stay away. But they're quite dangerous because they're frog hunters. And if you're trekking up streams, they'll be in all the same spots that you would want to put your hand as you kind of walk through big boulders. I mean, they will. And it's very easy to almost touch one. I've never been struck by one or struck at, but those snakes do bite people. It happens. And then there's another Habu that's really beautiful. It's sort of green to yellow colors, and those are the more aggressive ones. And that's, I mentioned earlier, we have a mongoose here. The mongoose was brought in, you know, over, I think, 100 years ago to get rid of these snakes because the Habu snakes, because they had so many victims from snake bites here.
I don't think that they are as deadly as they once were. I think modern medicine sort of just treating the symptoms, I think, is typically what they do, although there is sort of an anti-venom that exists these days. But people get bit all the time, especially the farmers. I shouldn't say all the time. People, I don't think, report it because they tend to be in rural areas. But I've met many people who have been bit by these snakes and they're kind of blew it off. Like, yeah, you know, I was pulling weeds and I got bit, you know, whatever. I don't know if it was sort of a dry bite or it's just they treated the symptoms quickly. But on occasion, you do hear about people still dying from a bite. But the aggression on this snake is quite profound. I mean, it's like, whoa, like they'll really come after you.
So I went on INAT and looked up reptiles and centered it on Okinawa Island, and see, it's pulling up 39 species in total. The one that is invasive, that's the at least one of them is invasive that I know of. The green, the well, someone from Tennessee, you're probably familiar with the green anole, so.
Yeah, I mean, those have been, you know, in recent years spotted on a few places in the South. And like everyone knows that's an invasive species, as you mentioned, but I've never seen one. I've never seen one. People I know have never seen one. So I think this is, you know, it's made its way on the list, but clearly it's a problem if it's wild here, but I've never seen one at all.
Yeah. And he said the black breasted was the only native freshwater turtle, or freshwater, but like terrestrial turtle.
Is the only freshwater turtle in on Okinawa Island. So when we say Okinawa Prefecture, it's sort of it's kind of like saying Hawaii versus a specific island of Hawaii. Okinawa Island is a specific island, but Okinawa Prefecture is like the whole, you know, a lot of small islands. So there are two other turtle species that are thought to be native to a few other islands, but those turtles have been brought to Okinawa main island. So although they are within the prefecture, so they're native to the prefecture, they're invasive to this particular island.
Okay, because I was looking at 9 and I was just seeing the common red turtle, I think it was called, and the yellow pond turtle.
Yep, those are definitely invasive here. And the interesting thing about Geomyta japonica, the black-breasted leaf turtle, our sort of star of the discussion, they hybridize with all these.
Really?
So this is the weird thing. Yeah. I mean, it's like it's a weird instance where if it's a box turtle, so the Quora, Flava marginata, and then sort of a subspecies, they hybridize with those, no problem. Yellow pond turtle, Maramis mutica, or the Kami variant on one of the islands, hybridize, no problem. The Maramis reevesii, which is the common reeves turtle, they hybridize with those, no problem. Pretty much all Asian turtles that live here, you'll see a hybrid of a japonica. And, you know, we try to rescue those animals because as soon as they're spotted, they're typically, you know, they're sacrificed or terminated, you know, pretty quickly. Yeah. But we try to get them into somebody who wants them as a pet so that, because they've grown up and lived most of their lives in the wild. So we kind of feel sorry for the animal, but they do hybridize with these other Asian species.
Oh, and I'm guessing the Chinese softshell turtle is another invasive.
They don't hybridize with that one. Okay, I should be clear.
No, that'd be impressive. That's like some sperm or something.
Yeah. So a lot of the Maramis, again, the we've seen hybrids of, and then in some of these, people have done experiments at home probably to produce, but definitely the yellow box turtle, the Chinese box turtle Quora, Flava marginata, those hybrids exist in wild and captivity. Reeves turtles, and then the what is the other one? The yellow pond turtle. Those are not uncommon hybrids at all to find. I mean, anytime you find a hybrid, it's kind of cool. But if, as far as hybrids, if you had to put them in a pool, japonica's in there. They just it's a weird, another interesting biology question to answer.
Okay. Yeah, but just looking through the species of reptile on it, it's pretty cool stuff. I don't know what the exact common name for this is in Japanese. All it's set point up is Okinawa pit viper, but species is Orophis okinavensis. So It's the one that's kind of you to like browns and stuff like that.
Yeah, so that's a himehabu. Yeah, so that's one of the habus. Yeah, so the habu, there's at least four different ones here, but because we live on these different islands, again, they come in different flavors, and sometimes they get brought over, and then even those habu will hybrid with the native, and then now you have a hybrid, so you have another animal you're having to deal with. And when I say hybrid, it's not necessarily a genetic dead end. Some of these hybrids are just that across that can still interbreed. So there might be a 25% of a native one and 75% of this other one that is a possibility here with some of these. I don't know so much about the snakes, but for the turtles, that has been shown to be the case.
Okay. And there's also shown forgive me, I don't speak a lick of Japanese, but pronounced Umeshima habu.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, did you say Kumejima or Umejima?
Kume.
Yeah. So that one, yes, that's Proto, a different island, but yeah, that's definitely
your Protobothrops flaviviridis.
Yeah, man, I can tell you, I'm a biologist, and I can't say any of this Latin stuff anymore. I haven't taken Latin in years, so yeah, it's. I don't spend my time on studying this stuff, to be honest, but I should maybe.
Oh, they have a species of coral snake as well. Huh.
What type of snake?
Coral snake.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot about that. So yeah, there's in the local dialect, maybe even in Japanese, it's called the high hebi. So hebi just means snake in Japanese. So high hebi. Beautiful, cool pattern though, the one that you're talking about. It's like sort of red. I mean, it's a coral snake with a different, you know, a color arrangement, but really rare, very cool snake. We do see them.
Yeah, for those at home, the scientific name is Cynomicrurius bokeri. Bokeri? It's spelled B-O-E-T-T-G-E-R-I. So do that what you will.
Yeah, it's...
But yeah, that's more like almost like a rainbow snake.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Problem is, all of my books over here in Japanese, which is no good because my Japanese is not great, but I know the ones that are. I know some of them. But yeah, the high hebi, which is the one you're referring to in Japanese, is really, it's a cool snake. And they were thought to be kind of endangered, and or not endangered, but because I don't think they've been examined for, you know, conservation status, but they're thought to be kind of like rare and kind of died out or something. But in the past few years, so many photographers have been finding them and posting online, but really beautiful. There's a lot of people on Instagram that have been taking pictures of them.
Yeah. Well, sounds like you need to plan a herping trip to Okinawa then.
Yeah. I mean, it's a cool, I think as far as herpetology, more on the amphibious side, you're going to be more impressed because there's lots of cool frogs. You know, we see newts everywhere. You know, there's a few different types of newts here, but frogs like crazy. And like where I live and sort of more in the northern part, at nighttime, it is so loud. Like if you don't have the air conditioner on, like you can't sleep. The frogs are so loud. And, you know, they're all trying to compete for airspace. So they just get louder and louder. But lots of different types of frogs. There's a really pretty one called, in English, the Ishikawa frog. And they kind of like a lime green. Sometimes they're a blue, kind of black spotted frog, but really beautiful and beautiful, like sort of calls and songs that you'll hear in the forest. Those are kind of sort of the more cherished animals that people want to come here to see. So they'll be that one snake or that one animal. This was definitely somebody, the herps want to see that particular frog. Another one that's invasive here, I believe that's pretty common is the Taiwanese beauty snake. So we're quite close to Taiwan, but those are quite long and very friendly snakes. We see them around, you know, all over.
All right.
I'm looking at our list here. You know, we have the same type of, a lot of times you see some of the same animals that you see in the US. So like, I'm sure you have like little blue-tailed skinks.
Yeah.
They're running around here as well. Yeah. Yeah, we see those here. I'm trying to think. There's also a green grass lizard that lives here. I won't even attempt. If you just type in green grass lizard Okinawa, you'll see it. But that really long, slender lizard. You know, the thickness is, you know, less than that of like a pin. But absolutely, you know, beautiful lizard, and they're not super afraid of humans. So if you kind of put your hand down there, they'll literally crawl right on your hand. You can handle them, and they have almost like a monitor or skink type of tongue where they're kind of flicking it around, and you can just hold them. I mean, they're really, really cool, especially in the northern part. I just don't think that there's a lot of predators or something. I don't know. They just don't seem to be afraid of humans, but very cool lizard. They can be green to brown, but typically they're quite a bright green color.
Okay.
And then there is a it looks like it's called the Okinawa tree lizard is the common name here. But these are really pretty lizards that are everywhere, and we see them throughout the forest, but even out in our garden here, which is a little more open. Really pretty lizard there. Maybe the largest one I've ever seen might be like 20, 25 centimeters, but they tend to be a little, you know, maybe half of that. But you can find the little ones that are like, you know, the size of the, you know, I don't know, maybe your little finger, quite small. And the colors when they're young are so, you know, they really stand out. They can be yellow and orange and red. When they get older, they tend to be more green.
And for those at home, that the scientific name for those is Diplodermata polygonatum.
Man, you're a pro.
No, I just high school, my one biology teacher, he had a list of prefixes and suffixes that you had to learn, so it just helps break down the names. So
Yeah, I mean, I took Latin and spent a lot of time in Greek, and it just didn't stick, you know. What can I say? Some of the species I've worked on the longest, like, you know, when I was on the academic side of things, you know, maybe in a multiple choice test I could get it right, but you know, we just don't think about. It's actually maybe a good point to make here is that I come from more the basic science world, where we're interested in sort of fundamental mechanisms that sort of transcend the individual species that have relevance maybe across the animal kingdom. So we don't get as hung up on technical, or maybe not technical, but sort of the, we're not working on a spectrum of different species where we're thinking like, you know, this gecko and this gecko or this snake and this snake. You know, we're really just thinking about a mechanism, and the animal is just a kind of as a tool to help us reveal what could be going on there. So we tend to not be good at all these naming, but I'm gonna work on it.
all right. Before I forget to ask, how can people find reach out to the center, and is there any way they can help contribute to the center?
Absolutely. We have a website. Maybe I can post a link somewhere, but it's just okinawa-kame.org. That's our website. And on there has all links to our Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram. We're most active on Instagram because that seems to be people most interested in the species of turtle on that platform, although Facebook's a close, you know, second. But you can sort of learn about kind of what we're doing at a high level. If you want to know the details, you know, send me an email or send our website a message, and I'm happy to set up a call and we can get into really more specifics on the projects. But if you're interested to sort of support the conservation, the easiest way is just to sort of share the content and tell people about it. You know, this is a small island. The other two islands this turtle lives on are much smaller. And once the turtles are gone, they're gone. And we see no breaks being put on the land development side of things. So, you know, getting the message out there and sort of putting the pressure on the local, you know, government to sort of do something is really the best way. And I should say, local government's doing, I think, a fantastic job of promoting the, you know, wildlife and nature here, but every little nudge helps. So sharing the content is the easiest way. If you're interested to become more involved, say, you know, you want to donate or something like that, we do have a donation system on our website where it's very simple to use. I won't even like waste the time. But contacting me directly is probably the best way to learn more about how you can be maybe a little more hands-on or contribute to a specific project that might be of interest to you. And then if you have any special skills that you think could be useful, we're open-minded. If you're a designer or something, you think you could come up with some great t-shirt or sticker that you think could be used to promote the turtle where you live or even here, would be really open to that idea. So please visit our website and then our social media links.
All right. Before we log off, is there anything else you want to talk about?
I think that's it. And unless you have any specific questions about, life in Okinawa or something like that, if you want to come visit, as a herpetologist or, field person, I'm happy to answer any questions like that. It's a long way from the United States. I assume most of the people that listen to your podcast are living in the U.S. or the English-speaking world, which obviously that could be closer than I expect.
Looking at my show note demographics, I do have at least a few Aussie listeners, so I might be a little bit closer.
Yeah, we do have people from Australia and in New Zealand who do come look for animals, and I think they have a good time. It's in general, what we see from the Westerners is that they're very hands-on. They want to pick up the snake and touch the animal. And there's a lot of animals here that are legally protected. So maybe something I should mention here is that this turtle has protection from, say, multiple government bodies. And so if you were to say, pick this animal up, you could literally, if they wanted to, charge you with a $50,000 fine or put you in jail for 5 years. I mean, it's pretty steep. And this isn't the only species that sort of falls into that category. Now, typically if it's a first offense or it's just, you didn't know it's still just a turtle to most of the government here. They can't tell the difference between a yellow pond turtle, to be honest.
Yeah.
So there are these, still, protections in place.
Still, it's probably not a good idea to advertise yourself on social media holding it or something like that.
Yeah, you were
just more in the general, but
yeah, for the most part, I would recommend to not handle most of the animals here are they tend to be endemic to some degree. Now the exceptions are those invasive species, which are in some cases are fair game or are in a gray zone where they're protected on one island but not on the island you're at. So then it's kind of like, well, which way can we go here? But if you do come and visit and want to look at animals, find a local person who's sort of experienced. There's, if you just go on social media and you can search in English, photographers, they tend to be quite open to taking people out and showing people around. But be careful because, some of these animals are obviously dangerous. I'm sure you have plenty of experts who handle venomous animals, but, think about if you get bit by a venomous animal and everybody around you only speaks Japanese, how are you going to communicate?
Probably kick in.
Yeah. I mean, and again, just to give you an idea, the closest hospital, especially in the northern part, they're going to have to put you on a helicopter or something to get you down south. Probably you're far away from, help. I'd say that's the main thing. Even if you said, I'm just going to go for it. There's some risks that involve, so always be careful if you come and visit, but do come and visit and take pictures of animals and share them with people, because whether you like snakes or lizards or frogs or this turtle, a lot of people don't know so much about Okinawa, this small little island in the Pacific, and we love when people share with the world what's going on here, because it's quite unique.
All right, I do have a little story to tell you after the we go offline, but with that, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Nate.